Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. If you've reached a certain age and visited the doctor, then chances are you've had some screening tests recommended. Screening tests are those defined as sorting through the general population to find conditions common enough to justify the cost and that are treatable at an early stage. Think about breast cancer, a condition that in all its forms will affect 1 in 9 women over their life course. To screen for it, the medical profession recommends all women undergo mammograms, with the idea that if there is a suspicious mass, it'll be caught early and subject to removal. The age to begin mammography varies by risk factors, like a family history of the condition, but you get the idea. Colon cancer is another common disease that is more easily treatable when caught early. Groups like the American Cancer Society recommend colon cancer testing for all adults starting at age 50 and earlier for those with elevated risk profiles. Yet 1 in 3 eligible Americans either don't know or choose to opt out of screening for this condition. As with many things medical, the consumer-oriented nature of America means that we have more screening tests available than ever before, including ones that you can choose and pay for yourself without a doctor or using health insurance. This offers more individual control, to be sure, but may not always follow the best scientific evidence. Helping us sort out the plethora of tests is the cover story of the latest issue of Consumer Reports titled "Medical Tests You Do and Don't Need," written by my guest today, Teresa Carr, who is a freelance health and science journalist based in Austin. Carr was a Knight Science Journalism Fellow at MIT in 2017 and 18, and a previous Consumer Reports cover story she wrote titled "Too Many Meds" was nominated for a National Magazine Award. Teresa Carr is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Teresa Carr, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's just start by having you remind us, what's the purpose of screening tests? What are they and why do we do them?
Well, thanks so much for having me. So a screening test is a test that's done in someone without symptoms. What you're doing is you're trying to uncover signs of hidden disease. So that's as opposed to a diagnostic test, which is a test you might use for someone who has symptoms when you're trying to find out what's causing them. And there's a reason that that distinction is so important. It's because a test can be really good for diagnosing someone and terrible for screening. So when you're testing someone who has symptoms, it's more likely when you get a positive result that what you're seeing is something real. But when you test a healthy person, there's a much greater chance that a result could be a false alarm. And if you like, I can give you an example.
Yeah, please. Give us, that's exactly what I was going to ask next.
So let's take a really common test, electrocardiograms. People call them EKGs or ECGs. So that's a really great diagnostic tool. And it's used for somebody who's at a high risk of heart disease or if you had chest pain or shortness of breath. And it can help your doctor determine if you're at risk of having a heart attack. But let's say you're at low risk for heart disease and you get an EKG. Well, chances are that a blip on your EKG is just that. It's just a harmless blip. But now your doctor is probably going to feel compelled to chase down that blip, and that can lead to more invasive tests and even treatments that you don't need. You know, you can wind up having angiography or even, you know, in some cases, angioplasty.
And these are tests, angiography or angioplasty, they're much more invasive where a doctor would insert a catheter into a big artery in your body or vein and thread it up through into your aorta and up into your heart. I mean, so very invasive, risky, but done, you know, hundreds of thousands of times in the U.S., but would be unfortunate if you didn't really have blockage in your arteries to go through something like that. And of course, not without risks of causing what's called a dissection where you can tear the inner lining of the vessel, those kinds of things. So that's a great example, EKGs. What are some other examples of, well, first of all, I guess, how did we get so many screening tests? I mean, we know about the ones, I think, that are well-publicized. So there's mammograms for women because breast cancer is a common condition. There's colon cancer screening for all of us because that's another common condition, common enough and treatable enough if it's caught early. But there are many other types of screening tests that have varying degrees of recommendation. I mean, how did we wind up with so many?
Yeah, that's a good question because I feel it too. It just feels like we're bombarded these days with like all these invitations to get screened. I mean, you're driving down the freeway and there's a billboard, you know, saying, hey, you know, come to our hospital and get a heart CT scan. You might be at a football game and a bus is there and they're doing free prostate cancer tests. Or maybe your church is hosting a company that comes in and offers a battery screening test. So I think one thing that's different today is it used to be your doctor, you know, might send you something in the mail, said, hey, it's time to come in for your mammogram or your colonoscopy or your yearly, you know, visit or whatever. And now there's just, I think, so many more places that are trying to sell you a screening test.
So is it the profit motive or, I mean, a combination of profit and public health, both?
You know, I think it's both. I think there's a lot of awareness on the part of the public about preventive, you know, measures. Certainly with the Affordable Care Act, preventive screenings are fully covered. And I think that's led to both people being more aware of screening tests and getting more screening tests, although, you know, there are many tests are still underused. But there's also this other whole side of it, which is like, you know, people marketing tests directly to consumers. And I think that there are probably several reasons why that's taken hold. Part of it is I think we're seeing the effect of really high deductible health plans. People don't realize that their preventive screening tests are going to get covered, or they want tests that they think they need that are not part of the ones that are typically covered. And they have high deductibles, so they go looking for tests themselves. That's part of it. Part of it is opportunistic. The market is there. You know, they can sell tests directly to people, and they do. And people really want to, they're taking, I think, advantage of people really wanting to take care of themselves. And, you know, that's the result.
Say a little bit more about high deductibles. So you're saying that in a sense that people want to spend that money to hit that deductible so that anything beyond that is covered. So by seeking out these direct-to-consumer tests, they're meeting their deductible?
No. And I probably said that. I didn't give enough explanation of that. I think because of high deductibles, people are not going through the main healthcare system. I think knowing that it's going to cost them a lot of money, they go and do these direct-to-consumer tests, which, by the way, are often, you know, not in your insurance at all. So they don't go towards your deductible. You're paying strictly out-of-pocket. These are things you're just kind of bypassing the mainstream healthcare system. But they think that they may get more different tests more easily. They might wind up saving money versus if they had them at their doctor or hospital, even though in the end their doctor may not. These often aren't tests that their doctor ever would have recommended.
I see what you're saying. So, yeah, and they being out of pocket, but there's the sense that you're getting some kind of bargain, especially, and I've seen these advertisements, the people coming, these companies coming to church, for example, offering you this bundle of tests with what seems like a discount or bundled price. But what they don't tell you is that if you wind up testing quote-unquote positive or there's a finding, that then they will share that with your doctor if you identify one, or they'll share it with you, but that will require typically follow-up testing. And as you pointed out earlier, if it's a false positive, that is something that's not read as normal but can be in the realm of indecisive or uncertain, then it will require you to essentially go and then seek further medical testing as follow-up, and sometimes on a periodic basis, even for repeat testing for months or even years.
Right. I mean, those can wind up costing you so much money. And the other thing that's really important, and we could get into this a little bit later, but the other thing that's really important to know about those companies that come around and offer packages of screenings is those are typically not recommended tests. In other words, they're not recommended by major medical associations. And there's a good reason for that. You know, there's not evidence behind them to show that they're helpful. You know, they're not proven to help people live longer or better. So, you know, for the large part, the tests that you're getting there are not tests that are recommended for you. And so the results, and they're not terribly accurate, particularly in people who, like I said earlier, are people who don't have symptoms. A lot of these tests are not accurate for screening purposes. And so you're getting a test that's not terribly accurate, that's not recommended, and you wind up with results that it isn't clear what to do with. And you can follow up with your doctor, and certainly should, but that can lead you down a whole other road of testing just to make sure, you know, out of abundance of caution, that nothing is really wrong.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Teresa Carr, who is a freelance health and science journalist and author of January 2019's Consumer Reports cover story with the question, Too Many Tests? And the headline on the article is Medical Tests You Do and Don't Need. And Teresa takes us through at least 18 different screening tests. I mean, reading through this, I thought, wow, you could spend almost all your time just getting screening tests. And of course, many of us who are health obsessed, I probably include myself in that, are very, read these things and think, wow, you know, I just need to get tested every year. And I think there definitely is a little bit of overkill. But Teresa, do you have an example of how a screening test can cause harm? I mean, we've talked about incidental findings requiring follow-up, but in the story, you talk about a gentleman named Ron Braithwaite, if I'm saying his name correctly, in Portland. Is that a story you can recount for us?
Sure. So one example we give in the story of the way a screening test can cause harm is the prostate cancer screening test, or it's called a PSA blood test. And this is, we're not saying, this is not a test that we're saying is not recommended. This is a test that the evidence is equivocal enough on it. It's one that you really need to talk to your doctor about. And I think, Ron's case is one of those reasons why this is something you really need to have a thorough discussion with your doctor before you have this test. And, you know, the problem with the test is it's just not as accurate as we would like. You know, there are a lot of common conditions, primarily like an enlarged prostate or maybe, you know, inflammation in the prostate or mild infection that can cause your prostate, your PSA levels, to be elevated. And even if the PSA is high and because it's detected cancer, you know, a lot of times those cancers are slow-growing forms that would never have spread or caused harm and you would never have known about if you didn't get this test. So if you screen 1,000 men, about 1 out of 4 of them or 250 of them is going to test positive with this PSA test. And of those men, about 100 of them are going to decide to have prostate biopsies. And that's what Ron did, is he had a prostate biopsy. And I talked to several men that had, for the story, that did have prostate biopsies, and all of them told me it's somewhat painful. So this is a somewhat painful procedure to, you know, sample several bits of your prostate. And the other thing about that procedure is that it carries a known risk of causing serious infection. Because of you have to, like, not to be too graphic, but you have to put the needle through the rectum into the prostate itself, and so you have the risk of carrying bacteria into the prostate. And so Ron, who in our article, developed sepsis, which is a very serious bloodstream infection as a result of his biopsy. In the end, he is recovering, although his heart has still been severely affected, and thankfully he didn't have prostate cancer. But it was a lot to go through.
And you pointed out that at the time he underwent that testing, he was 66, and the United States Preventive Services Task Force only really recommends, it's equivocal in its recommendation, but it says definitely men 70 and older shouldn't have prostate cancer screening because the risks outweigh the benefits for reasons just like this, and that if you get prostate cancer at an older age or diagnosed, you're more likely to die with it than because of it. And there's definitely a subset of people with prostate cancer for whom watchful waiting, that is just surveillance and not doing surgery or radiation, is probably the most beneficial course, least harmful course for that matter. But there definitely is a subset of people for whom prostate cancer can be aggressive and can metastasize. And that is actually where the science is. It's particularly vexing because, you know, we would like to be able to know, and maybe the genetic revolution will help us with that. We'll be able to find markers that will help us determine which prostate cancers can be left alone, as strange as that sounds, and which ones probably need to be treated.
Right. I think that's the crux of the matter when it comes to prostate cancer. You know, we're getting better. So right now, the way the numbers are stand, you know, I started with my 1,000 men, and they got PSA tests. You know, of those, about 80 are going to test positive for cancer. And until the last, let's say, a few years, and it's still in some places it's common for nearly everybody who tests positive for prostate cancer to be treated with surgery and radiation. And the problem with those procedures is they commonly cause impotence and incontinence. So this can be like a life-altering thing. And when you look at the numbers overall, if you start with those 1,000 men, the PSA test is going to prevent one cancer death. It's going to prevent the cancer from spreading in 3 others, and 5 men are going to wind up dying despite, you know, testing and treatment because the cancer was aggressive. In recent years, it's true that a lot of doctors have gone to watchful waiting. I think that can be psychologically difficult for some men, knowing that they're living with a cancer that you're just sort of keeping an eye on. And there is some research to suggest if you're prepared for that ahead of time, if you know that's a possible outcome, it's something that's easier for you to accept. And I think that's one reason why, if you're a man and you're considering getting a PSA test, it's so important to sit down with your doctor and just walk through these numbers. And there might be reasons based on your medical history, your family medical history, or your own personal values that you may want to get the test, and it also may be a perfectly acceptable reason to hear all that info and say, no, I don't.
Teresa, I'm wondering if in the people that you interviewed for the story, you posit something very reasonable, which is that we have a discussion with our doctor about what our values are, and you come to some form of shared decision-making about the value of a screening test. But I think all too often in American medicine, because of the fear of lawsuits or what have you, defensive medicine as it's sometimes called, it's just easier to order the test than it is to have the discussion, and especially in a workaday world of doctors and patients where doctors have to, you know, hit their target of number of visits in a day to kind of keep the business churning, often these discussions aren't really happening to the optimal level. Did you come across that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why even in the mainstream healthcare system, you see overuse of certain tests. I mean, you see underuse as well, but you do see overuse of certain tests. And I think, you know, some of it is just because guidelines change and doctors don't always keep up. And some of it is people coming in and say, well, I know I had a colonoscopy 2 years ago, but I feel like I need another one. And the doctor says, okay, fine. That might be an extreme case. But yeah, I mean, I think sometimes it's far easier just to order a test. And, you know, aside from colonoscopy, which is a little more invasive, but a lot of these tests are simple, you know, and they're blood tests, they're scans. The tests themselves seem pretty simple and safe. So it seems like an easy thing. It's the easy thing to do. I would say if you don't have a doctor that will discuss tests with you ahead of time, then you should really shop around. And another thing that's really helpful for people, given that doctors today are under time pressures, is to go look up the recommendations. I mean, you can start with our article. That's one place. But, you know, go to the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. A lot of times they have things that are written in plain English for consumers to give you the recommendations. So go in. That gives you at least a starting point to have a conversation. And it might be different for you. Those are guidelines. We give the case of someone in the very opening of the story who had colon cancer screening. And she had colon cancer screening earlier than would normally be recommended, but for good reason, because her father and her father's sister died both relatively young of colon cancer. And in her case, she had screening. They found a polyp. They removed it. And, you know, she's fine.
And she definitely thinks that that saved her life, or that she was able to find it and get it at a treatable stage where it had not progressed to cancer. And that was, you know, sort of an ideal story of screening done
right
appropriately.
Right, right. Screening is a terrific thing. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm definitely not down on screening tests. Screening, according to recommended guidelines, can be life-saving for absolutely sure. And in some cases, you know, improve quality of life. It's not even life-saving. That's a, you know, extreme case, but it can improve your quality of life. It can find your high blood pressure or your high blood cholesterol or your high blood sugar, for example. Those are very simple screening tests. It can find them before they go on long enough to cause you real problems.
Teresa, I'm wondering if in your research for the article, were you able to come up with numbers in terms of the costs to, I guess, the healthcare system of the screening test industry, as it were, or what the, you know, the downstream costs of false positives are?
Well, I know my editors would have loved me to answer yes, that I could find that. And I did dig and dig and dig and dig to find that. And the answer to that is, yeah, honestly, I don't know. You know, I know it's hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's likely billions of dollars, but we really don't have many studies that are looking at the cost of unnecessary tests and unnecessary screening tests specifically. If you look just at the mainstream healthcare system, we found, you know, a couple of recent studies. There was one done in Washington State using about 2.4 million health claims. And they were looking at a set of overused tests and treatments. And some of the ones that were most overused wound up being screening tests. And, you know, that set of overused tests and treatments cost consumers and their insurance companies about $282 million in a year. So that's one state and one set of you know, 2.4 million healthcare claims. So that's just, you can kind of extrapolate that out.
Yeah, if you extrapolate from that, it's got to be in the billions because that's just one state.
Right, that's just one state.
Wow.
Beyond that, there's also a large market for tests that are sold directly to the public. And, you know, I found there are market research firms that track certain aspects of that market, but nobody is really keeping tabs on how much Americans spend on these tests. Remember, these are out-of-pocket dollars, so nobody's really tracking this. And there's definitely nobody that's really looking at the downstream costs. Like, so when people went and got that, you know, packet of tests at the church, you know, what they had to spend then going to get more scans and more stuff to follow up on some of those uncertain results, nobody's tracking that.
You had a figure in the article about direct-to-consumer lab and genetic tests where that market is projected to climb to $350 million annually by 2020. And this is just really a fraction, these direct-to-consumer labs and genetic tests. I'm curious what your thoughts are on, I mean, I have not had too many patients at this point who come in. I have people come in with employer-sponsored wellness checks where they have lab tests, but I haven't had people, and maybe that's because they're not coming to the doctor and they want to just self-manage their care, but where they're going to the lab and getting their own blood tests, ordering their own blood tests, for example.
Yeah, I think that's a growing market. I mean, there's a company in Arizona, now I'm forgetting the name of the major lab company. Anyway, they partnered with a grocery store chain there to open up labs in the middle of the grocery store. And Arizona is a state where you can do that. You can walk in and order your own test without having a prescription or a doctor order. That's a growing field, and it's something I think you're gonna see more of. It's part and parcel of our sort of fragmented healthcare system, I think. People are so used to it being fragmented, and they're used to paying out of pocket for a lot of stuff that it's not unheard of for them to think about just walking in and ordering their own lab test. So I think that's something you're going to see more of.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Teresa Carr, freelance health and science journalist and author of January 2019 Consumer Reports cover story asking if there are too many tests and medical tests you do and don't need. Teresa, without going through all of the ones that the article covers, there is definitely, and you allude to this in the article, a mismatch between some tests we do too many times and some we do perhaps too few. What are there paradigmatic examples of things we do too little?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, right off the top of my head, I believe that about a third of people that are recommended to have colon cancer screening are not getting it, according to the recommended guidelines. And remember, that's one that's fully covered by insurance at no cost to you, and it doesn't have to be colonoscopy. It can be, you know, there can be other much, much less entailed, much simpler tests that are also very good screening tests for colon cancer. So, I mean, that's one example off the top of my head. But I will say, in this country, we have this real problem with both underscreening and overscreening. And I'm not just talking about, like, you know, overuse of the direct-to-consumer test. I mean, this happens in the mainstream healthcare system. One example we give is osteoporosis screening, which is a scan to, you know, measure bone density. And guidelines call for a one-time screening for most women 65 and older. So we looked at a study that found that about half of women in their 50s who are at low risk, and most of them are mostly not recommended to get this test, about half of them were getting it. Meanwhile, in women 75 and older who had a much higher risk of having a fracture, about 6 out of 10 of that group were not getting the test. So in many cases, we're not doing it right. You know, we're not getting the screening to the people who need it. Another great example is cervical cancer screening. I mean, there are you know, several studies showing that we are screening women who no longer have their uterus and cervix, and they're still getting their, you know, annual or biannual pap smears just for cervical cancer. That's, you know, that's silly.
Hard to have cervical cancer, although not impossible, but hard without a cervix. Teresa, I want to shift gears a little bit here and ask about you. You were a staff reporter for Consumer Reports for a number of years, but are now more freelance. Another thing I learned is that you're actually from Tulsa or spent a significant part of your childhood here, but are now based in Texas. So how did you get into health and consumer reporting, health and science reporting?
Right. So I grew up in Tulsa, and I moved to Broken Arrow, which is, you know, basically Tulsa, when I was in junior high, and then moved to Texas in high school with my family. So and I still have family in Tulsa. I was just there last month. But the way I got into what I'm doing now, I always loved both science and writing. And so as an undergraduate, I majored in English literature and physics. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do with that. And then I found out that you could combine those. So I got a master's degree in science writing. Through college, I was working my way through college. I was doing technical writing. But my first real journalism job out of grad school was working for Consumer Reports. So that's how I started with Consumer Reports. I was hired to be a product writer, so I wrote about things. But I, you know, with my background in science and the things I was really interested in and drawn to, I started doing more and more health stories. Eventually, I left Consumer Reports and I took, you know, a somewhat circuitous path with my career, but I came back there a few years ago, and I was on staff for several years until I left last August. I took a fellowship at MIT in science journalism.
And as I understand, a show we did, an article that you wrote or participated in more than a year ago, Too Many Pills, for Consumer Reports, was nominated for an award and won an award.
Right, right. I think it's Too Many Meds.
Oh, sorry, Too Many Meds.
Yeah, right, that one. Great article, loved it. It was a culmination. I worked in a group at Consumer Reports called Best Buy Drugs, and I think that article was a culmination of a lot of our team's, you know, in-depth research over a period of years. I highly recommend it. Yes, so it was a finalist for a National Magazine Award, and recently it won an award from Folio Magazine in the investigative journalism category. So I recommend that people check that out. It's still online for free at Consumer Reports.
It was definitely a worthwhile article. I totally agree. Well, congratulations on the award. And you'll also want to see Teresa Carr's cover story in the January 2019 issue of Consumer Reports titled Medical Tests You Do and Don't Need. And that was written by our guest today, Teresa Carr, who is a freelance health and science journalist based in Austin. Teresa Carr, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.